Welcome back to Beat Seeker. I'm your host, Matt McButter. In each episode, we explore the shifting world of music with world-renowned experts and artists to take you deep, deep inside the fascinating and changing world of music technology and music discovery.
And I'm your host, Mike Weider, reminding you to subscribe in Apple Podcasts and give us a five-star rating if you like the episode. You can visit our website at beatseeker.fm, where you'll find plenty of rabbit holes with extra content to dive into, guest backgrounds, and even a playlist with music recommendations from each of our guest episodes. Also, BeatSeeker swag. You can stay current and talk to us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at BeatSeekerPod. The vast majority of people go to YouTube for video on the web, but when it comes to music videos, Vevo is the OG. Jointly owned and operated by the big record labels, Vevo specializes in streaming music videos and artist-exclusive content. Even when you stream a music video from YouTube, chances are it was served up by Vevo.
Taking us inside the company is JP Evangelista, Vevo's Senior Vice President of Content, Programming, and Marketing. JP oversees Vevo's original content, production, music programming, editorial, talent, events, label relations, and social teams globally. He's the ideal guest to explain how Vevo works, having been with the company since before its 2009 launch. We reached JP in New York City. JP, welcome to BeatSeeker.
Thanks so much for having me today.
JP, when most people think of watching music videos on the internet, they probably think of YouTube, but your company, Vevo, is really at the center of the music video ecosystem. For the people that aren't maybe that familiar with Vevo, can you explain what Vevo does and how it came to be?
Sure. So Vevo is the world's leading music video network. We were established by Universal Music Group and Sony Entertainment back in 2009 as a joint venture with one fairly simple mission: to maximize the promotional and commercial value of music videos. So at this point in time, we've amassed a library of over 800,000 official music videos, ancillary music video content, live performances, interviews that we distribute across a wealth of different platforms, YouTube being one of those key players that you've already mentioned and recognized, but across an entire connected television network, CTV network, as I'll continue to refer to over the course of our discussion, with over 150, you know, linear, essentially traditional, now former cable-based, but now internet-based channels that we distribute across Samsung TV Plus, Pluto, Roku, Hulu, and a host of other places.
Okay. Now, I'm sure the labels are fiercely competitive in a lot of aspects of their business. So why did it make sense for them to work together on videos?
Right. So there was a clear opportunity around the revenues or lack thereof generated around music video at the time of Vevo's inception back in 2009. If you sort of rewind back to that point in time, the industry was facing several challenges. One of them was piracy, copyright issues, everything revolving around, you know, Digital Millennium Copyright Act at that point in time. But another area that was vastly underserved was sort of advertising supported revenue when it came to music videos and the model in which the labels approached different distribution points to license out their music videos. At that time, Universal, Sony, all the majors, most of the indies licensed all of their music videos to a variety of platforms. And what that in effect did was lower the per play rates against music videos wherever they existed. The role that we came in to serve was to really maximize the value and have sort of a one-stop shop where advertisers could come to us to purchase in front of music videos and amass that library sort of in one place so that you could really raise the value of the videos themselves with the advertising community and what could be generated for revenue overall.
Okay. I get it. And I mean, I remember going to Vevo.com as a destination, you know, years ago. To confess, I haven't been there recently. Can you sort of explain that evolution from it? I guess it sounds, from what I'm hearing, it sounds like it was always intended to, you know, to be distributed across multiple platforms. But can you explain the evolution maybe from Vevo.com as a destination to this explosion across other platforms, smart TV platforms, Roku, and that kind of thing?
Yeah. So when we launched, you're correct in saying that we were Vevo.com, and then we had a very sizable presence on YouTube. over the years, the way in which fans have consumed music video has shifted a bit. And the way that we've tackled how we're servicing fans with our entire library of content has shifted. So in 2009, you would have seen Vevo.com, our YouTube presence on desktop. Circa 2012, 2013, we would have launched our mobile app right around the time that YouTube Mobile had started to grow and start accepting and licensing music videos apps. So we existed there as well. And then circa 2018, we really began to grow our connected television footprint. What initially began as us having proprietary apps on Apple TV and Roku grew into a much larger network where we're now servicing multiple platforms with our proprietary apps and have now grown our linear channels to exist, you know, essentially an offering of 15 channels to exist, you know, in over 30 different destinations currently.
Wow. And you've mentioned a couple of stats, but I just want to, dig into those a little bit and make sure I didn't miss them. So, what's the size of the Vevo library and number of artists and can you share some consumption statistics with us?
Yeah. So broad scale, the library is 800,000 music videos this time. We produce 1,000 pieces of in-house produced original content a year. That's largely performance-driven content, but also includes some interview-type footage and some more artists speaking-type content. The size of the audience right now, just for an overall consumption perspective, we're doing about 25 billion views a month. The biggest area of growth that we've seen across that consumption in and of itself has been on TV, as I referenced, and that's why we've evolved to a place where TV is such a priority for us. So just 4x growth alone for consumption of TV in the past several years, where it's now representing 1/3 of our total views in a given time. And to get even more stat heavy beyond that, last year alone, 5 billion views across our proprietary apps and FAST, that's free ad-supported TV channels. So that's all activity occurring on our partners that don't include YouTube.
Wow, those are some incredible numbers. We wanted to talk to you a little bit about the evolution of the music video. And, you know, Matt and I grew up in the MTV era. You know, there was Friday night videos, I can remember. You know, that was a major event as a kid. Seeing the new videos, and we watched them pretty much all on TV. A lot has changed since then and the early days of MTV. You know, you mentioned a lot of stats about, you know, TV and other platforms. But like, how are most people consuming videos and how is that evolving?
So overall right now, the majority of people do still continue to consume music videos through mobile. It's our largest traffic source. The viewing sessions across mobile are vastly different than what we see on television. So on mobile, you might see sessions where users consume on average 1 to 1.5 videos. So they're in, they're out, they're in, you know, whatever their app of choice is to consume video. For us, the majority of that mobile usage occurs on YouTube. Whereas on television, most of our sessions, our average session duration is 30 minutes. So more of a traditional sort of programming block that you would see back in traditional cable in the MTV days. And it's a much different user experience that they're being served in our television environment than they are on YouTube and mobile, for instance. In the television environment, depending on where they land, they're either in our proprietary app or they're consuming one of our FAST TV channels. In our app, they have the ability to stream in a lean back sort of programming curated type of way where across different half hour and hour blocks, days, times, moods, genres, they're really being serviced what they've come on their programming guide to land on. In our video on demand app, as you would see on many sort of video streaming services, they can cut and slice it in many, many different ways. They could filter it by different artists. They could search for different artists. There's plenty of rows of programming that are curated in the same style that you'd see in a Hulu app or a Netflix app. So very similar style, and that's much more of a lean forward type of environment for them to consume in.
Yeah, that's interesting. So why do you think you mentioned that the TV was growing fast, very quickly, I think you're quadrupling in size, you said. Why do you think that is? I would have just thought mobile was the key driver still. Is that maybe because these smart TVs are getting better or smarter and the experience is more interesting for consumers?
Yeah, I think it's safe to say it's it's a multitude of factors. I'd say one of them was timing, right? So we really began to see this shift in TV pre-pandemic, but during stay at home, when more people were, you know, confined to their homes for a period of time, the viewing habits we saw really, really gained momentum during that period of time. And they've essentially sustained during then. Plus, if you look at hardware manufacturing, you know, a company like Samsung TV Plus, many more people in the world right now have an internet connected TV than they did 5 or 6 years ago. Plus, beyond that, a proliferation of streaming services where we're able to distribute our videos to in that more linear, lean back type fashion now.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, so clearly consumption is different as technology has evolved. You know, what about the role videos play for artists in the industry? Like, you know, there's a lot of alternative video formats now, like, or just competitors for our time, like Instagram, TikTok, and so forth. You know, has this significance or importance to artists in the industry kind of endured, or how has video survived under that, you know, competing alternative formats for our time?
Yeah, I'd say as a marketing and development tool for artists, it's probably as important now as it's ever been. And that's not just evidenced in all the stats that I've shared with you around how heavily consumed these videos continue to be on a regular basis. But think about the landscape that an artist exists in now and the amount of digital service providers and platforms they have to service themselves on a regular basis and the type of content creators they have to be. A music video serves as a central rallying point for their fans, and singles are still marketed heavily, both by major and indie labels. There's full teams that get behind them. And you do need a visual piece to really rally fans around and sort of centralize some of those consumption habits. What you also see in the advent of many of the audio streaming services now is songs gaining sort of mass appeal, and fans might not even be able to connect an artist's face to that song just because of the algorithmic boost it's gotten and how quickly it moves. So the music video really helps to serve the artist's vision and be able to connect fans back to that artist in a deeper way than, you know, having something just algorithmically serviced in a playlist to you across any number of audio services right now.
Yeah, I think like I can definitely relate to that. You know, often like I'll have a playlist playing, someone might ask me, you know, who's on, and I put this playlist together, but I couldn't tell you who's playing because, you know, it just maybe came up in some algorithm. I added it to a playlist, but I don't really know them well. Obviously, there's a bunch of artists I listen to more where, you know, I know them extremely well, but there's a lot of content just like you described where you have a shallower relationship with the artist. And you think that's because of algorithm derived content?
I think it's one factor. I think, you know, you also referenced, you know, fragmentation and attention and time. I think there's a huge service that the artists are able to tap into across social media to get their personalities out there. But it's really syncing up all these assets simultaneously, having the music video there, having the way, you know, unfortunately, at this point, they need an artist sort of, the demand is for them to present themselves as a brand to their fans and to be able to service all these different applications. So they must create tons of content to keep up in this algorithmic world. Having the music video handy as a simplified way of being able to present themselves really services them.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. What about the video content itself? Like, what's different about a music video today versus, you know, 10, 20 years ago? What are some trends that you're seeing in terms of the content itself?
You know, it's interesting because it's ebbed and flowed heavily over the years, right? Like right now, I could say that it's as similar as it was with big budget videos that you would have seen back in the heyday of MTV. But we've had pockets of time in which you've seen artists really be able to create great videos on a budget and be able to gain mass scale across those. So it ebbs and flows, but really I haven't seen, except for the screens in which it's been consumed on over time, a mass difference in creative. I know that there's sort of a future eye towards what might be possible in the VR and AR scape across that medium. I haven't seen anything in mass proliferation yet, other than, you know, a one-off here and there across different labels trying different things that would suggest that we're anywhere near seeing, you know, mass scale VR videos in the music video scene yet. We've been talking about it for a good 6 or 7 years and it's still not quite there yet. I'm not sure if that's, you know, a device penetration issue or just, you know, general artist adoption to that medium yet, but not something I've really seen yet.
let's shift gears to that sort of, you know, future view. I've been involved with VR for many years and, you know, sort of anxiously awaiting more mass adoption, which has certainly been slow to come. And with, you know, layoffs at Meta, who knows when it's, you know, when we're actually going to achieve any kind of mainstream adoption. So what are your thoughts on, you know, VR, you know, the state of it? Do you think it's just device penetration? Do you think it's still coming? Are you still hopeful that it's something that's around the corner?
Look, I'd say, you know, personally, not speaking for Vivo at all, I'm an Oculus user. I enjoy it. I think there's some practical applications that you could have in environments like Roblox and other places in the future that have already begun to do some stuff around music video. But really an artist's challenge right now in releasing anything is being able to cut through the noise. And if you're looking at a smaller user base in a singular environment, it doesn't make sense for them to be a central pinning point of a release strategy, right? They sort of need to be everywhere. Now, using that as incremental in addition to right now, sure, totally see it. But, you know, overall, to be able to grab people's attention, to be able to cut through the constant stream of content that's released everywhere across YouTube, Spotify, every social network, TikTok, right? It's a challenge for them. And when they're making decisions as to where to put content into and where to put their time into and where to get the greatest impact from a marketing perspective, I don't know that the value prop has been completely established there yet. Doesn't mean it won't be in the future, but I think it's just a little ways off still.
Yeah. So what you're saying is that they're already stretched thin and struggling to produce content for the existing mainstream sources, sort of betting on some, you know, futuristic thing is probably not worth their time.
Artists are just being asked to do more than they've ever been asked to do from a content creation standpoint. I mean, I'm not alone in saying that, you know, Sir Lucian Grange came out and said that recently and others have said that as well. So it's sort of a, it's an industry known problem, I'd say at this point. And it's sort of, you know, how does that get rectified across varying algorithms across different platforms currently?
Mm. And so what are your thoughts on maybe how viewing and platforms might change over the next 5-10 years?
I think you have to look at the impact of, you know, shorter form, but where I struggle to see a massive shift there is the creation of singles hasn't changed when you look at different tracks. Right. You could argue that there's been some shortening in length, you know, from a 330 format down to maybe 245 in some instances. But to go down to 15 or 30 seconds, you know, vis-a-vis, you know, a TikTok or a YouTube Shorts, I'm still struggling to see like a mainstream single at that length of time. But that is something that, you know, comes up in this discussion when, you know, an artist is strategizing around content, what they should be making and is impacting the choices that they make as to what they record, what they release, how they're spending their time. I fully believe in the strength of music video and the traditional single. I haven't seen anything statistically that gives me pause to say, I think this is, you know, going downhill fast in any way. It's been quite steady from both a consumption perspective, from being able to monetize that format and being in a place where advertisers want to be around particular types of content. We still feel very bullish on where we're at. Yeah.
Hmm. Artificial intelligence, AI, is another technology that's, you know, rapidly moving from, you know, more the realm of sci-fi into the mainstream. You know, art is made by AI. People are, you know, writing speeches, writing essays by AI. Certainly on the music creation front right now, there's a huge story in the news about a song by, I think he calls himself Ghostwriter, who used AI to clone the voices of Drake and The Weeknd and create a sort of Drake sounding song. There's another tool where you can, you know, make your own Drake song, all that kind of stuff. So this is getting a lot of attention. Do you think this is going to move into the video creation world, or maybe it already has and hasn't come on my radar yet, but do you think, do you see this coming into the video creation world?
I don't see any reason why it won't. Now, our perspective on it is we are stewards of official music videos, and given that of intellectual property and copyright, right? So it is an area that I think overall we're looking at, the industry is looking at and understanding the need. Like, reference back to where I kind of started this with Vivo's creation and around piracy issues and copyright issues and that of protecting intellectual property, it's an area where every platform is going to have to ensure that they're protecting the rights of the content providers that are delivering to them, distributing through them. And it's an area that we certainly take very seriously. The way that we're structured and the way that, you know, videos come onto our platform, we have the ability to pre-review stuff before it gets posted, you know, through our back-end feeds, all that sort of stuff. So I feel confident in our ability to ensure that we're protecting those rights. We have less of a, you know, obviously there's a ton of user-generated content on YouTube. That's not an area that we protect ourselves. That's something that our label partners do. So I'd imagine if it becomes an issue, they're going to have to be, you know, somewhat vigilant to ensure that their, you know, intellectual property is being properly protected.
Yeah, there was a story this week about UMG requesting of the streaming platforms to block AI bots from scraping the content for this exact issue that Matt was talking about. Is that an issue that's relevant to Vivo, like in the video world, and that if people start to ingest all these videos for the purpose of creating generative AI or derivative works, are those issues that you're actively having to deal with today, or just ones that could be on the radar in the future?
It could be on the radar in the future, but the way that we're set up, that's different than a typical, and now we're getting sort of in the tech weeds a little bit, and I hope that's okay. But the way that we're set up that makes us a bit different than YouTube and other platforms is we don't have the ability to have user uploads onto our platform and have those videos then distributed. Everything comes to us through a licensed provider, right? Mm-hmm. So could there be a bad actor out there in the future, right, that uploads something that we would then have to have reviewed and figured out? Sure. I'd say the likelihood given our licensors of that is fairly low, but you can never really say never, can you? So, but it's certainly less of an issue, maybe more future facing, and not something that would even come up remotely regularly for us.
Interesting. Sort of along the same lines, are you familiar with a video? It's a bit old now. I think it's from 2016. An artist, I think, who calls himself Soda Jerk, who remixed sort of like a collage of old found footage and video and various pop cultural references to a song by the Avalanches, The Was. Familiar with that one?
I cannot say that I'm familiar with that one.
Kind of along the same lines. I should send you that link. I actually think I should post that link for our listeners as well. It's a pretty, I would call it a must watch, a pretty amazing sort of collage. It's almost like a, yeah,
like kind of like a video mashup where it's sort of he's created his own music video behind the song. Is that it?
Exactly. Yeah. Gotcha. I'm drawing a blank right now, but what's the French artist who did that? I'm losing.
It's going
right
to drive me crazy too. There were several remix artists who did this, and this was really popular around 2014, 2015, 2016.
That's right.
That works in a YouTube environment. For us, we don't tend to deal with those sort of types of videos because everything needs to be fully commercially cleared when we release it because of the way that we're monetizing it.
Yeah.
So that really falls under the realm of, you know, UGC, more professionally produced UGC, that then the appropriate rights holders would have to block, claim, monetize whatever they decide to do on YouTube or whatever environment it's being uploaded to.
Yeah, well, it seems like the genie is out of the bottle, if you will, and it's going to be tough to defend against this thing completely. I'm wondering whether, you know, the industry needs to instead sort of embrace it and try to monetize it in some way so they're getting fairly paid. But the idea of fans creating thousands of or millions of iterations of your music videos, your songs, you know, using AI, I mean, it seems inevitable. And it also seems probably very difficult to defend against completely. So I think we're probably in for more of this stuff, not less.
Yeah, I mean, you saw something very similar before the Content ID system was installed at YouTube, right? Where you had tons of fan rips going up constantly, and that was of existing stuff. So probably easier to match from a tech perspective. But I imagine, you know, with the advent and usage of AI across different fanscapes, that the monitoring software, which could also easily be created by AI, will follow suit as well. So it's a question of, you know, what catches up first, what goes first, and then what sort of policies does the music industry want to instill to ensure that fair compensation to protect intellectual property rights?
Got it. Girl Talk was who I was thinking of, but yeah. Finally. So JP, we also like to ask our guests if they have a music recommendation. We've got a guest picks playlist. So can you give us something to throw on our playlist?
Yeah, absolutely. I am very, very into Renee Rapp right now. The single is called In the Kitchen. The video's out. She is signed to Interscope. She was just part of our Discover program for new artists. And for me, the vibe is very Olivia Rodrigo, Driver's License. And you might be seeing it that high on the chart later in the year if I'm correct. But I'm, cool. You know, crystal ball, it feels good, but let's see what happens.
All right, listeners, you heard it here. And finally, JP, if our listeners want to follow you or your work, where's the best place for them to go?
Yeah, so LinkedIn, probably. And I am just, you know, at JP Evangelista on LinkedIn.
Fantastic. JP, thanks so much for being with us today and telling us all about Vivo.
Thanks, appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Beat Seeker with your hosts, Matt McButter and Mike Wider. If you like the show, go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts and hit the subscribe button. While you're there, leave us a rating and a comment and share it with your friends and colleagues. If you want to dig deeper into this content, visit beatseeker.fm. That's BEATseeker.fm. Interact with us on social media at BeatSeekerPod. BeatSeeker is recorded in the Devil Lake Studios and the Tunnel Under Arundel. The show is produced by Matt McButter, Mike Wider, and Kate McCartney. Thanks for tuning in, and keep seeking.